You are now locked into Radio Juxtapose, the home of contemporary art and culture conversation.
Coming up today.
I come from a long line of criminals. No, it's kind of like, so if you came from a nice family, like they wouldn't think that's a good idea, Ron. You know, but if your family are all meth dealers, they probably think Ron's almost on the straight and narrow compared to the rest of us, you know?
This is Radio Juxtapose.
That's right.
You sound very scary.
It's funny. I was on TV this morning, like at 6 in the morning, and the cameraman was auditioning to be on The Rabbits. And I was like, I don't think we're a show yet, dude.
Wait.
But I'm glad you're into it.
Is that how you started today?
Yeah, we came over at 6, yeah.
For what, like local TV?
Yeah, local TV. So we'll actually be on the news at 5, and we were on the morning show. So
that's how we're going to start this Radio Juxtapose podcast with Mr. Ron English, legendary.
We're at DCon.
We're at DCon.
DCon, yeah.
We are at DesignerCon 2019.
We're deep in the DCon.
I'm experimenting.
And I did a collaboration with D-Face at DCon. So.
Yeah, I was doing a blog post about that the other day, and I had to make sure I got all the...
D's in there?
All the D's in there correctly.
Yeah. And my middle name's D, so...
Is it really?
D English, yeah.
What's your middle name?
A lot of D's. D.
It's just literally D?
Well, it's actually fucking. don't you hear people saying it?
Fucking Ron.
You testify. You saw when people come up to me where they say my name is.
It's Ron fucking English.
that's my middle name. I'll show you my license later.
No, actually, walking around with you here, you just got stopped like 3 or 4 times. You've been in this scene. You've seen this scene ebb and flow. You've been part of it. You've been influential to it. But it feels like we're at a big moment again, like where things have gotten more popular.
It's hard to tell. We're here at DCon that I've seen a lot of artists here that I haven't actually seen for years. So I don't know where they've been or what they've been doing. Maybe they were gobbled up by the fine art world. Now they've been spit out. I couldn't tell you. You actually probably do know. But... like Tim Biskup, Gary Baseman, a lot of those, Camille Rose Garcia, like she quit making toys like 10 years ago.
Right.
And now she's got a new toy. So,
see, I'm the opposite. I think that there's been a renewed energy around buying art in the last couple years, that collectibles are the more approachable thing again. Mm. And people really want to get that accessibility back.
Yeah.
But. Maybe that's just being optimistic.
Okay, well, first, I absolutely never understand what's going on, and nobody's ever accused me of understanding. But I always have a theory, and I'm always proud to spew it. But years ago, I thought, well, this is a really interesting culture. All the buyers are, you know, 20-something designers and things like that, and people in the creative industries. So one day, they're not married. So a lot of them aren't married. So when they get married, like this ends. We're going to hit this tsunami of marriage. And all the, you know, the wives would be going, are you kidding me? No. and it seemed like that kind of did happen, you know, which is also interesting because we've been doing a lot of stuff in China, and that's a great audience. There's 10 times more people there.
Right.
Like, you know, I do something with a rock star there, and I'm saying, I'm sorry, I don't really know who you are. And he goes, well, do you know who Jay-Z is? And I'm like, yeah, well, I'm 10 times bigger than Jay-Z. Just because you don't know me doesn't change any of that, you know. But they're... It's like 80% women that are standing in the lines. And they're, you know, 20-somethings. And so I feel like, okay, well, if the women are buying it, then we're safe. Because then people can marry their collections instead of one going, no way, you know?
Is that something that you would say is a particular trait in Asia, or is it here too?
No, that was there.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So here it's still boys?
Oh, no, I mean, I'm old enough to remember the first Comic-Cons, and it was comic books. And there were not women, you know. And one of the very early ones, you know, in San Diego, I have a character called Kathy Cowgirl. So I got a Vegas stripper and, you know, I painted her with the cow dots or whatever and put big breasts on her. And, well, she already had big breasts, but, you know, I put the nipples on her. And I just wanted to promote the character. And we were selling a lenticular. It was actually amazing, but the production cost us so much. But it actually animated. She walked by full color. But it cost $20,000 a piece to make. So, like, our market at the time wasn't going to sustain something like that. But anyway, so I had her there to help promote Kathy, and she started getting mobbed. I mean, bad. And I kept trying to hand people a card. This is who the character is. We're trying to sell this. Nobody cared.
Yeah.
They were just oogling her. And my wife was with me, and she was going, you know, if you ever do this again, she needs, like, 10 bodyguards. So, but then after that, the anime came in, and a lot more women got involved. And that part of Comic-Con is kind of over.
Yeah, and I had a conversation with Alex Pardee earlier today, and we were talking about, is this scene, because I'm always looking for, like, what's the historical lineage of this? We can talk about street art, and there's a lot of ways to kind of explain where it came from and what it came out of, but this particular scene, is it comic books?
No.
Is that the origin? No.
No. What happened was they came up with the technology to do roto casting, and a lot of it was for a couple purposes. One is to maybe a part of your injection plastic mold, there has to be some weird part that has to be a little more softer vinyl to fit in there. So they were using it for that. And then they were also using it to create prototypes so that executives, you know, could look at stuff. So, like, if you think if it costs $60,000 to make an injection mold, you know, that's probably a lot of money to put something together, put it on an executive's desk, and him go, could you make the tail turn the other way?
I see what
you're
saying.
Well, let's drop another $60,000 and we'll make that happen,
right,
sir.
Right.
And how about your assistants? He has some changes too. So, but a lot, but it also created.
But when does this go back to?
Oh,
this years?
Is. It starts with Eric. So, it's been about 15 years. It hadn't been that really long.
Okay.
And I think it was Eric. Well, Michael Lau is the one I'm friends with. So he said, yeah. So, he realizes there was this technology,
okay,
and he thought, I'm going to exploit it in a different way than they're using it now. Because also another thing I can do is I can make small runs of toys. So he started making these small runs, running it out of his apartment or his studio. So kids would line up for blocks, they would buy them, and they're sold out. The gardeners.
How was that communication happening?
I'm not sure how he was getting to his fans.
Yeah, that's part of this I'm so fascinated with, is that part of this.
Well, back then, it was the early days of the internet, so he was probably one of the early people to use the internet.
Yeah.
And, you know, people tell each other.
Right.
But anyway, then some companies started wanting to do it, and then they decided, well, let's do it in America. And first they got kind of a lot of, I guess you graffiti artists, right? And because they thought, what's the hottest thing? Well, graffiti. So they didn't really have characters. So they tried to do kind of stuff, and it was kind of falling flat. And then I think they said, well, we still want to be involved in this culture. And somebody said, you should look to the Pop Surrealist.
Okay.
Because the Pop Surrealist have characters in their paintings.
Exactly,
a lot of them
yeah.
have repetitive characters. So,
absolutely.
So, you know, I think I actually met Lev at Toy Tokyo, and then he did Super Size Me,
right.
Super Size figure.
Yeah.
But then they realized that that's when all the Pop Surrealists became a part of the movement. So the American vinyl movement was a lot of the Pop Surrealists in the beginning.
Yeah, because my first entree into toy culture would have been like kind of the only two graffiti guys that were having characters would be like Futura and Kaz and like the Bounty Hunter Japanese scene.
Right. Yeah, Bounty Hunter was one of the early
yeah.
guys.
And
yeah. So we would go over and do stuff with them.
Yeah. Okay.
Before we really even had toys yet. So.
Right. Okay. And. But your relationship to this scene grew out of the fact that you had characters to be made.
Right.
Right.
And so, you know, they asked me to make stuff. So I did Ronnie Rabbit for Dark Horse. I did MC Supersized for Lev. But, you know, he didn't actually promote it. He sold it under the table because he was super scared of getting sued by McDonald's. Which
right.
I kept saying, I'm not going to sue you. They're not going to sue you.
Right.
It's my character. I own the copyright to it. It's
right.
not... Unless they want to say, oh, yeah, this is actually what McDonald's does to you, then that's not going to happen.
Which they're not going to admit to.
Right, right. I did one with Kid Robot, but it had three tits, and they nixed it and never came out.
Okay.
It actually came out years later when I was more famous and that they could make money off of it. Little fuckers. But anyway, that was kind of, you know, so the scene had already kind of begun when I was in it. And they already had their rules. Like, at first they said, well, if you want to be a part of this scene, Ron, you know, the dynamic is kind of cute with a little edge of threatening, but not too much. No politics, absolutely no politics, and no sex. But I figured, well, I'm not going to make a career out of this. You know, I got
right.
this other career painting or whatever, but this sounds like a lot of fun. But of course I'm going to do sex, and of course I'm going to do politics. That's who I am. But and what kind of delighted me was, well, also, as you look forward into the culture, I thought the culture is going to get bigger. A lot more people are going to get involved instead of this small, nerdy little crowd. And I'm sorry, in the beginning they were. Now, when I did Kathy Cowgirl, they freaked out. They were like, this is horrible, this is sexual, blah, 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 blah. And I'm thinking, first I thought, wow, they're hipsters, you know?
Right.
And then I realized, wow, these guys aren't hipsters, they're nerds.
Right.
They're anal retentive little fucking nerds. But I thought, you know, but this is too cool. I know the culture is going to grow.
Right.
So the first one I actually produced myself, not through another company, was Fat Tony. And because it was, you know, addressing the obesity situation in the United States and the contamination of our food and yada yada and the cereal, I got in time. I got an NPR. So like the first day we sold like 7,000. Then we just kept selling and selling after that. So I kind of like I said, I'm not going to play the game the way you guys play it. I think it's going to get bigger, and I think that the fact that I do politics and bigger social issues is going to actually make me bigger.
You have been at the forefront of some really nerdy shit in terms of Burning Man, which to me is nerdy. I don't care what anyone said.
I'm nerdy.
Comic-Con. Yeah. I know, but you also you kind of got in before even there was even any. I shouldn't say nerdy. I should say cult followed things.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Because nerdy kind of isn't quite right.
Right.
But those moments when you're kind of around your friends and colleagues and people, contemporaries, and these things are happening, do you kind of ever take a step back and be like, I think this something's happening here? Or are you kind of more just in the moment and that's just how you're going to do things?
Well, I mean, I did billboards. I kind of fell backwards into that because
yeah, right.
I was doing photographs, and I was part of a scene called Fabricated to be Photographed. Maybe the most famous person that came out of that was Cindy Sherman, right? But I was still in school, and so I kind of got swept into that, and I
this
didn't really understand
late
70s, that scene.
Correct?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
So I didn't understand that scene was like something that was getting attention and even existed. But it's kind of like dogma in film, where you have like certain rules that you have to live by. With the photography, whatever was going on had to be really happening. So I tried to make weird perspective tricks happen and stuff that would be impossible. And so I existed in that space doing that. But when I started including billboards in the shots, I wanted the billboards to address what was going on in the foreground. So I had to go repaint the billboards. So I'm running around Dallas repainting the billboards, but as props for my photos.
Right.
Because whatever in the thing is, when you look at a Ron English photo, that's what's really happened. Figure out how he did it. You know, and it may have been, you know, perspective tricks, or it may have just been repainting the whole billboard.
Right.
But the other young painters who were kind of locked out of the system, because back then it was pre-Keith Haring and stuff, so an artist wasn't really going to have their first show till they were in their 30s, you know, and we were way too impatient
for
that.
Yeah, there's that
yeah.
whole idea that a young artist having a solo show in New York was not a thing.
Right. It was just exploding then.
Yeah.
The East Village had a lot to do with that because it was run by young people. And also they felt locked out of that scene. So a lot of that culture of the early 80s came from youth culture that was locked out of the scene.
And, yeah,
and we didn't have the patience to wait. But they saw the billboards. It's like, my God, we can have these giant outdoor art shows. And believe me, when you're 19 years old or 17 years old, you're not thinking about money yet.
Right.
You're just thinking, I want to make art and I want people to see it.
Right.
You know?
Right. And there's also this idea, too, that you're really good with is that not everybody can afford an expensive painting. So in order to sustain kind of a long career, you kind of have to find ways for people to be able to buy your creativity in a way.
Right.
And it's not just a painting. And it never has been for you, which is, I think, you've kind of you created a blueprint, I think, for other people.
Well, I just wanted to do stuff.
Right.
And I mean, I was just talking to a young artist 5 minutes ago. Oh, I can't afford to do this. I can't afford to do that. And, you know, I wasn't going to tell them. It's like, dude, when I was like 19, I wanted to paint every billboard in Texas. How am I going to afford to do that?
Right.
I mean, I couldn't possibly afford to rent even one of them. How am I going to afford to paint? I mean, I'm going to paint them. It's going to be cheaper if I just paint them myself. So I figured out that the billboard company has like 40 trucks. They load them all up with paint. And then in the morning, they load them up at night, and then the guys come in the morning, jump in the trucks, you know, get their coffee, and they drive to the location, and they've already been stocked with all the paint they're going to need for the day.
Right, okay.
You know, 3 gallons of every kind of color they have.
Okay.
So we would drive down there and break in and just unload all the trucks into, like, a big van, fill it up, or my pickup truck, fill up the whole back so you could see out of the back. So I always had hundreds of gallons of paint. But I got it because I was stealing it, you know
and
what I mean?
You were like, I want to do this, so I'm just going to do it.
I don't give a fuck. I'm going to do this.
Yeah, right, you know? Exactly.
I come from a long line of criminals. You know, it's kind of like, have social pressure in your life. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So if you came from a nice family, like, they wouldn't think, that's a good idea, Ron. You know, but if your family are all meth dealers, they probably think, Ron's almost on the straight and narrow compared to the rest of us, you know?
Yeah, what did you have family that you were showing them? Hey, I'm doing these billboards and these sculptures. I'm doing this whole thing.
Yeah.
Did you have family that was like, Ron, what the fuck are you doing? Or Ron, this makes sense.
They didn't think much about it. I made paintings for my uncles, the meth dealers, and they lost them or traded them or I don't know what they did with them. You know, and I don't know. They just didn't. At one time, my dad just, you know, he just thought of some lost cause. And then one time he saw me on TV and he said, wow, I saw you on the TV. It's like, you're somebody,
yeah,
right? And so it's evidently, that's what, like, kind of actually the moment I realized, wow, TV's very powerful. It kind of changes people's minds.
Well, also,
I mean, that's our president. It's like, why do we have a president? It's like everybody saw him on TV. They thought that's who he really was.
Also, you know? I think when you started, the idea of being an artist, it wasn't really something that everybody was like, that makes sense. Nowadays, it's like you can tell somebody that you're going to be an artist or you're doing an artistic practice, and it seems a little bit more common. But I could be wrong.
No, you're not wrong.
Okay.
No, but there was nothing we could do. There was very few outlets, you know, for an artist. You know, now there's a million outlets. Right. I don't know if that makes it better or worse. I don't know if having access through Instagram or something, you know, makes your art life easier, or maybe there's more competition and more people want to be an artist. So
right.
I don't really know what it's like to be a young artist now.
It
seems like it's easier, but I don't know.
Right,
maybe it's way harder.
You were already well established by the time social media came around. So you didn't ever have to have that pressure of like, this is my only avenue.
Well, our social media was underground magazines and stuff.
Right.
So, how did I know who the BLF was? Well, because they were these weird underground publications that we would try to get our hands on, and then they would talk about this group in San Francisco, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, they're doing the same thing I'm doing. You know? But it took us literally 20 years to meet.
Right.
We finally met, and we started doing billboards together.
Is that how you met John Law?
That's how I met him.
Yeah,
somehow he sent some crate to my house. He figured out where I was. He sent it to my loft. They said, I'm going to do a stunt. My name is John Law, and I'm going to do a – oh, I'm sorry. His name was Jack Napier back then.
Okay.
And I'm going to do a thing in New York, and I'm like, I don't know who the hell you are. And, you know, but he showed up at my house, and then we became best friends and started doing stuff together. And
When did you become, like, aware of, like, the Robert Williams
– Well, I knew who
path.
Robert – I knew Robert Williams was when I was in high school.
Okay. Because of the Zaps?
Well, we lived in a very small town, and the Zap Comics was like a portal to another world.
Right, right.
So my big ambition in high school was to, I wasn't smart enough to want to be Gilbert Shelton. I wanted to be Fat Freddy, you know what
okay.
I mean?
Yeah.
I wanted to sell weed and live in San Francisco. So I had no concept of the...
Did you ever sell weed and live in San Francisco?
I never lived in San Francisco.
Okay.
Never lived in L.A., although everybody thinks I'm from L.A. It's funny, But...
I would have thought you would have lived in San Francisco for even a couple years in that late 70s era.
No, I went to Austin.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, which was kind of a wannabe
San Francisco.
Again, you're
one of the early people in Austin.
Yeah. You know, I gentrified a lot of places.
I blame you for Hoboken.
You know Deep Ellum is now blowing up, but we started Deep Ellum in the early 80s. So Theater Gallery, I used to have shows there. R.E.M. would play at the opening and stuff.
Yeah.
And also we would get giant warehouses and show giant pieces of art. I mean, I don't think anybody ever sold anything. Oh, one of my favorite times was I worked at a photo lab blowing up these big murals, right? So we called the show One Shot because we were just sort of getting ready one shot at showing some giant art or something.
Yeah.
And we were printing it at work, these pictures of these handguns with scopes. So they were just designed to kill people, you know? And so I thought that was kind of interesting. So I put it all over I put a huge mural of it on the front of the... in front of the warehouse. It's like in downtown Dallas, right in downtown Dallas, with big picture windows in the front. So I covered all the picture windows with that. We had our show. A guy had a giant painting just on the other side of the windows on the inside. Of course, it wasn't a real art show, so it lasted till about, you know, 2 or 3 in the morning. And then we all said, oh, we know this all-night cafe. Let's go there. And the owners went upstairs, or the cats that lived there went upstairs. And about 10 minutes after we cleared the place and went to the cafe, some rednecks came by and just with shotguns just blew the whole front windows out. But if we would all been there, like a lot of us would have been dead. So, but they just saw that one shot and they were probably drunk and in their pickup truck and let's take our one shot. So
that kind of that makes me feel like that's a
interactive
performance art.
Yeah,
sort of.
They did to one of my billboards one time. They shot it full of holes. Yeah, but at least they were noticing it. I was happy about that.
You're a political artist. In many different ways, sometimes quite literally, sometimes like a little bit more playful and a little bit hidden. What's going on right now when you're making art that's political, do you feel like it's almost everything's so obvious now it's harder to make political commentary? Like we've hit this part where like the joke is actually happening.
I don't know. I don't know if the joke is happening. I mean, everything makes sense.
Right. Yeah.
But I do know that I'm getting messed with by robots. You know, that things are happening to me because robots are deciding that I'm not, that I'm bad, you know, which is kind of weird. I don't get pressed like I used to. So, like, I'm literally building a wall on the Canadian border and building this huge wall along the southern border, and we get nothing. Nobody wants to touch it.
Now, why is that?
I don't know, because I can't get into somebody else's mind. But I do get the feeling, especially being down there, you know, they said, we're scared. We're really scared.
Okay.
And yeah, because I was like, you know, can I buy this land or rent this land from you? And they're at first they're excited and, oh, we, you know, we really want to make a statement. And then they're like, you know, no, we don't. I've seen some very powerful people back down.
Right,
because
there
is a kind of fear that's kind of permeated our society. And nobody wants to be associated with the stuff I do now.
Right. And because...
But, you know, I have more wall than Trump does, you know? I'm winning. I have a different theme to my wall and a different purpose, but
does it feel like making a comment about Trump now just seems too obvious and it has
Well, I
to
think
be-
it's too easy and I do find that some of my other activist friends, you know, like if I sit with them and say we can't talk about Trump anymore, we have to pick a candidate or some platform of the Democratic Party because that's all we're going to get. And we need to start promoting it viciously. You know, that's what we did with Obama. It worked with Obama because we, you know, the basic concept was, well, they called us and they said, well, we want like eight top street artists or whatever. Like, so they got David Cho, Shepard Fairey, myself. But, we realized that if we do it, then all these other street artists can do it. And also you create the dynamic of this is a winner. And I hate to say it, but people want to support a winner.
Absolutely.
No, they do. They want to be on the winning side.
Right.
And if it feels like it's the winning side, this is what we're doing. I don't want to be the only guy that goes, I didn't like him, you know, or whatever.
Right.
You don't want to be left out of something, you know. So we kind of played that dynamic, but everything was positive. And, of course, I do all my snotty stuff. Like I did one of John McCain, and he's at a rally, and it says, I want to get erected. And then it says, sponsored by Pfizer. But, I mean, I did a lot of smart-looky stuff, and the campaign called me and said, stop it. I mean, we can't tell you what to do, but... If you stopped it, that would be helpful because we think that just staying positive is the way to make this work. And then so I dropped all that, just did Abraham Obama.
But
it worked because staying positive and being for something, not against something. Because, okay, here's the thing with Trump. Like, have you ever watched The Sopranos?
Yes.
Okay. Did you root for Tony?
Yeah.
Yeah. Tony is a brain-damaged, psychopathic horror show. Dumbass, mobster from Jersey's, everything that you would possibly hate in a person.
But you root
the most despicable because they introduced him first.
Right.
And I knew when Trump came down that escalator, because nobody had really announced and put themselves out there in a big way yet, I thought, fuck, he just won.
Right.
He just won because he just made it the Trump show.
Yeah.
And it didn't matter what he came down and said, saying crazy stuff, it worked. And I was arguing with my friends at the time that they were like, well, they cover every tweet. They cover every tweet. We're just sucking on Donald's tweets, you know? And it's like, you don't have to cover every tweet. You do not have to cover every tweet. You can say he says crazy stuff.
Yeah.
End. But, you know, he says, oh, no, he's a presidential candidate. Everything he says is very important. So we have to cover every tweet, which means now he controls the news cycles.
Right.
And he knows. He's smart enough to know. Now, this is interesting. I'm a friend with his ex-producer, right? And once I said, hey, well, is he a genius?
And she said,
of course not. He can't even read. And then she looked stunned. And stared into space for a minute, and she goes, oh, my God, he is. He is a genius. Nobody on planet Earth understands the business of the media better than he does. You know, he knows you just got to stay on. You have to
stay in the news.
Yeah.
It's interesting because we went through the years, you know, the early years with Obama where it was like the creative class really got behind him.
Yes.
And then this candidate is the complete opposite.
They went against him.
And it's like it, but he is his own vessel for news. And it's.
And everything is about him.
Everything
is about him. And a lot of the stuff he does is super, super smart. If you told me now, it's like, okay, we got to end this interview because, you know, the New York Times is covering this and they want like a couple quotes for me about the toy world. As soon as you said the New York Times, my brain goes, fake news, fake news.
Right.
Now, I don't think that, but they put that meme in my head. It's like you say New York Times, big news.
Even though he loves the New York Times.
Oh, he likes anything that lauds him, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
But he also figured out, and maybe he didn't figure it out himself, but, sometimes, being a genius, just rolling with stuff that's working for you, So the Russians did the original fake news, and they really went for him. If they're buying an apartment off of you for 100 times what it's worth, it's like you're their guy, Yeah, maybe there's some P tapes. I don't know. Like, the one thing that would kind of, like, I remember, like, the grab her by the pussy thing or whatever. They thought, he's done.
Right.
But because I was talking to my old homeboys from high school, I thought, no, he ain't done. He just said, I'm a rock star and I get to do whatever I want. Don't you wish you were me? That's what they heard.
Right.
Everybody else heard is like, this guy's a creep.
Right.
But that's not what they heard. They heard this guy's David Lee Roth.
Right.
Yeah. So everything the liberals thought that they had him on, no, that's a superpower. But even Trump thought that the women were going to take him down. He says, if you guys run me, which I'm into, but I just want you to understand that this is maybe the thing that trips it up. Because I'm a hornbag. I do what I want. But they weren't even smart enough to realize, no, they'll think this is a superpower. They're not going to think this is bad. They're going to think this is good. And even the women think it's good. Because, I do him as a billionaire,
Right.
So they were all, he talks smack good. So do we. Some stuff just magically worked out, Hillary was a bad candidate. Again, we were for Bernie. Bernie's like a real revolution. He's the real deal. We were raising money for him and supporting him. And then, then he got thrown under the bus. And then we contacted the campaign. And we said, we have called Shepard Fairey. We've called all the original eight that did the Obama thing. And everybody has agreed that we are going to get behind you. And we're going to go out there on the streets. And we're going to promote the hell out of Hillary Clinton. You in. And she said, no, you guys supported the wrong candidate last night. It's like, I don't need you. Goodbye.
Yeah, see, that doesn't...
Now, that's the wrong thing. You can never think, I got this.
I like this because this goes back to the power of the creative class, the makers, the DIYers, like the people here. Like, there's to this group of people.
Well, you knew how to use the creative class, right? Fucking Hitler.
Yeah, he was good.
No, he was optics because he started off as an artist. And a lot of times they just, to their detriment, they dismiss the creative class. And I would say 90% of the creative class are liberals,
Right, yeah, for sure.
You're going to have a hard time finding some artists that are going to support Trump or Hitler or anybody that's a totalitarian.
Right.
Because they're not that way. They're into freedom. But yeah, he used them, and he used them well, you know?
And I feel like Obama was the first time in my lifetime where I was like, that is using the creative class to energize and to create materials for you and to create campaigns for you, not even authorized, is very effective.
Oh, no, but the unauthorized thing was brilliant. That was Lincoln. He gave people a lot of access to him. You could come photograph me, and that's when you had to sit like for a long, minute, and it was not as fun
Abraham
to be photographed.
Lincoln did this.
Yes, and he said, look, if everybody's got a picture of me on their wall, they're going to vote for me. So I'm going to give artists, they can come, and it's fine. If they want to go make daguerreotypes of me or whatever and sell them and make some dough, I don't care. Because that's going to push my image out there and it's going to make me seem, I'm going to be a part of people's lives through, all these photographers and artists.
Wow, that's similar. I mean, it's not similar, but it's in the same sense, Hitler was one of the first people to use TV.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
But he also stage managed everything.
Well, of course.
But somebody, a despot, a normal despot would not be able to.
By the way, I don't want to put Lincoln and Hitler in the same category. Yeah, okay. I apologize.
Well, I think there's also a problem in society. It's like, some people are going to destroy the world. Some people are going to save the world. But to get your agenda out there, you have to have techniques, And so I think you can never just say that person's evil. So everything that they used to get to where they were at was evil. I'm going to throw away their whole toolbox. Do you see what I mean? And I think sometimes that's a mistake, But then again, I read an interview with one of the guys that does fake news. Not like one of the Russian guys, but like an American that's in the business of doing fake news. And he gets into it because he can make money off of it. And I don't think he makes a lot of money, he has a nice house in the suburbs and stuff. So originally, he made some fake news, got some ads, got some money. And then started hiring other people to write fake news articles for him. But he's a liberal, right? So in the interview, they go, well, why don't you mess with the Republicans? And he goes, oh, no, we tried. You know, it works on the, I'm sorry, why don't you mess with the liberals? And he said, yes, we tried. When we put out an article, it's like Hillary has, you know, killed people. The right wingers just jump all over it, and they're just like, oh, that, you know, they don't care about sourcing or anything. You know, they're just like, I knew she did stuff like that. Now, but if you go the other direction, he said, well, you know, it turns out that, you know, Trump has actually killed 19 prostitutes, and, you know, blah blah blah. And, you know, of course it's fake. Liberals, he says, look, they just go, what's your source? That doesn't sound right. What's your source? You show me what your source is, and if it's not a legitimate source, we're not. And they're just like, that's what liberals are like. Boy, you don't. You even if I'm just like, you know, I get one fact wrong, all my friends jump all over me. Oh no, that's not right, Ron. You can't put one fact into the formula, even if it's just you missed it, you know, by 100,000 when you're talking about 5 million.
Right.
No, wrong. So they're not susceptible to it. And so I'm not gonna. So he said, I'm not gonna make any. I'm not going to make any of this fake news for liberals because they don't buy it and they don't spread it, you know, so it doesn't work on them. So I'm not going to make any money. So, yeah, I feel kind of bad, but I'm making some money, you know. So it's interesting. So it worked on one side. So whatever our side, it's not going to work for us. We're not going to – disseminating fake news is not going to help us.
Right.
You know. Of course, none of us know what is going to help us, you know. But, you know, like, the problem is, okay, let's say – half of my family's from Iran, right? So this happened to them. And so our relatives are going, do you understand what is going on in your country right now? And we're like, yes. No, but you're not taking this seriously. It's like, actually we are, but most of them aren't. Most of them are just enjoying the ride and thinking, you know, I don't know what they're thinking,
right.
Or they're not thinking. But it's like, it you can't come back from this. If he really pulls it off, your country's done. And it's like, we know that, but we don't know how to stop it. We don't know how to stop it. But it's serious. Like, they used to be a liberal democracy.
Like there's,
and now they're a mess. Now if an artist draws a parliament, 12 years in jail. 12 years in jail for drawing the parliament. And then it's like, okay, then she meets with her lawyer. 5 more years for shaking the hand of a man.
Right, yeah.
And there are people, and you don't think about this, but there are people in Iran that think this is a really good thing. When they came down hard and they got rid of all the intellectuals and they get everybody with a passport's an asshole and, you know, everybody, you know, all the artists, fuck them. You know, when they, a lot of those people, like, you know, split to California. That's why there's this huge population
big
of super fucking smart Persians in California but we are the recipients of all their intelligence and brain power, where that should have been Iran's. You know, you can't throw away the elites, you know.
Yeah.
Or now they're we're seeing the deep state. It's the deep state. My mother-in-law's in the deep state. People in the deep states are competent people that do their job. They don't want that much money. They're not trying to get rich, and they're not trying to get famous. They're just doing their jobs to the best of their ability, and that's how this system functions. Otherwise, you just become corrupt. He's getting rid of all those people because they're the deep state.
Right.
But he's got people all paranoid that they're – there's nothing nefarious about the deep state. The deep state are the competent people that run things.
Right, exactly, who don't want any attention.
In a weird way, you know, most of the people listening to this are part of the deep society. If you're a plumber, you know, you're not doing your plumbing wrong. You're doing it to the best of your abilities, and you're probably quite good at it. You're doing your job, and you're making things work. Like, what if we took the plumber out and said, we're going to put my nephew in there who don't know how to do no plumbing? You know, like, that would destroy your business, you know? But you can't do that with the government either. There are people in our country, and 90% of the people in the country are out there doing their damn jobs.
Right.
And doing them well. And a lot of these people seem fucking stupid because they've never been that involved in politics, and they're not used to people lying to them for no fucking reason.
Yeah,
But I guarantee you know, if you're an electrician, you're doing a really good job, and you're very competent, and you wouldn't even think about doing a half-assed job, you know?
One of the reasons why we can talk for an hour about politics on this, and it makes sense with you, is that you've always been good at doing the reflection of, like, just like that little reflection of society back to itself.
Right.
Like, yeah, oh, you're going to the store to buy some cereal. Here's, like, a little funny comment about the way that what you're eating, what you're consuming, all the, like, you've.
But some of the stuff works.
That's why I'm saying, like, I like the fact that you're talking about this, because I feel like you've always been working on how society looks at itself, and when they actually get that one little hint of, like, hey, do you know what's actually kind of happening, they do react, and they do care.
Yeah, and nobody's going to immediately go, wow, I was wrong. Nobody's ever said that, those two words, except me just now. So, yeah, you have to kind of just be patient and let people, like, they have to come to it on their own terms. It's like, right. Every now and then somebody will say something like, well, what would be a good source? It's like, okay, that's a crack in their armor. If they say, what is a good source? What, where should I be looking for information? It's like, fuck, that's your moment to give them real places to find
what
real information.
People?
Well, I mean, if Trump calls it fake news, it's probably a legitimate news source, you know?
Right.
No, it's like there's a million news sources that are just making up stuff, you know? And if it triggers you and you think, that's great, I'm glad somebody finally outed Hillary for being a child molester, it's like, look at the source. And look at the reason for that source being. You know, we're getting played really bad, and we got to stop it, you know? The New York Times is still legit. And, yes, they you know, what Judith Miller was a complete screw-up and got us into war with the wrong country and yada, yada. I mean, they dropped the ball, but they're trying. You know, and they have real reporters in the field. They're not a bunch of talking heads. They're not sitting in their basement making up stuff. You know, there are people out there seeing what's really happening.
Right.
And there's very, very few. It's becoming fewer and fewer actual news sources. So,
when you put work in the public space and you're kind of asking people to stop and look at it and have a moment for it, do you at all feel like you're force feeding?
Because it's humorous.
Yeah.
It's humorous, okay. And it just throws you off a little bit, and I'm making you finish it. So it's we're having a conversation, even though it seems very one-sided. But you have to think about what does that mean? It's Think Different with Charles Manson. Would they do that? You know, but do you think, well, what would they do? How far would people go, and what's on limits and off limits? No, the main thing about being an artist, the first thing they teach you is just question everything.
Right.
And most people don't do that. They don't do that because you're tribal and, you know, I built my life around Christianity. Like my wife says, you know, it's the Christianity thing. That's one of the underlying flaws of the right. It's because their basic premise of life is wrong. And so it's easy to fool them because they believe a magic Jew flew up into the sky or whatever. They got some weird idea of something that didn't really happen. Do you know what I mean? And they couldn't care less if you find earlier text before, you know, but there wasn't a virgin birth for the first couple hundred years. They added that 200 years later. They don't care.
Yeah.
Well, God made a mistake and he fixed it. So there you go. Jesus didn't walk on water in the early renditions of the Bible. They see him. He's standing on the shoreline. It's foggy. They're going, he was so beautiful and the way the light shone on his robe. And it almost appeared as if he was standing on the water. And later, let's just make him standing on the water. You know? All right, do you think Jesus really, you think one of his big things to his followers is like, you know, you got to pay your taxes, you know? Do you think that fucker ever said that? No, he didn't. He was a revolutionary. He didn't say that. No, but when the Romans said, you know what, we're going to make this a state religion, how about if we take out the part where we kill God? Could we lose that part? And they're like, yeah, well, you know, we need to...
The power of a good
edit.
Well,
right now you're throwing us to the lion. So, like, if we can make some compromises because we don't... That's not fun for us. You know, so like, yeah, well, how about we'll have Pontius Pilate wash his hands, and this will be the statement that, the Romans aren't responsible for crucifying your God. But of course they were. The Jews couldn't crucify Christ. But the problem is now they're the guilty ones, but they're not going to, that's their guy. They're not going to crucify him, but let's make them guilty so that the Romans could be innocent. So if you do that, okay, we're in there. And you know that part where he says we're going to fertilize the soil with the blood of the Romans? What if we change that to render under Caesar's what Caesar's, you know, and like, you know, pay your taxes, you know, and they're probably like, okay, we could live with that, you know, I guess you got it, you know, but you can see what the Romans changed, you know.
I think what you're getting at too here is like the idea that you can live by certain values that you've learned, but they don't have to be literal. Like not everything has to actually happen in some... walking on water and these guys, it's like, just live by the good values. You don't have to be
but that's different. I mean, I love the Bible probably more than anybody. I've read it probably more than anybody. I've read earlier versions more than anybody. But, you know, I don't see it as like this actually happened.
Right,
I feel like it's kind of like this is, we're trying to conceptualize big ideas in poetic ways, you know? And so we have a shared poetry as a society that binds us together. But if you take it too literally, then you're going to leave yourself open to being lied to. You know, so like if I go see a Hollywood movie, I don't think that's real, but I think that has a a reality to it, emotional reality to it. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
But I know that didn't really happen, but I understand there was a protagonist and there was a hero, and it's the hero's journey. And
just like there's elements of Orwell's 1984 or Huxley's Brave New World that actually happened. I mean, that kind of have
kind
played
of did
out,
happen, yeah.
have played out, but they are sort of overall interpretations of how totalitarian governments might react to its people or treat its people.
Right.
So if in 250 years, 500 years, people read that and they go like, well, yeah, in 1932, they were giving people somas. It's like, no, that comes later.
Yeah.
That comes in the 90s.
Yeah. Well, I did a rock opera at the Millennium called Revelations Book 2, and it's like it came out, and everything, and it was about the second coming of Christ. Everything has come to pass that I said in 2000.
Really?
No. Boy, why do I always have to say no?
Yeah, you would have said like, yes. It would have contradicted everything.
I would have sold a lot
said.
More records. Yeah, yeah. If you're like, oh, that's how did no? I didn't even think about that. But you know, right the same day the buildings hit, and we were our studio's like right across the
yeah,
river.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. So and at one point everybody's kind of in some weird panic mode, and then and this one woman comes running up to me and says, "You knew? How did you know?" And she. They had this group of people that listened to Revelations, the record, and they could sing a lot of the songs, and they had all the lyrics printed out, and they were just like a little Revelations club
or
whatever,
yeah.
And they were having fun with it. But it's like, you knew, 9/11. I'm like, well, 9/11's my daughter's birthday, so like if I needed a date, I'm going to use that so I can remember it or whatever. But you're thinking, wow, okay, I didn't predict this, okay. But, you know, as a matter of fact, though, one of my mafia friends, you know, rented him for the first real chain tournament, he rented him the space.
Whoa.
And I'm like, why'd you do that? It's like, well, they paid cash. You know, I don't know what they were up to. I didn't think they were up to no good. I thought maybe they're making drugs or something. I don't know.
Are you a conspiracy theory guy?
No.
You don't come across.
Okay, but I do have like, okay.
Yeah, what are the ones?
Okay, one night I'm with one of my Jersey mobby kind of guys or whatever. And he we're just sitting at a bar, and he just starts crying hysterically. And he says, I killed those people. And I'm like, what people did you kill? He goes, I killed the people in the World Trade Center. And I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. And he goes, we had the contract. The contract that, you know, because they keep trying to figure out why. There's 17 inches of insulation foam. And it didn't hold up. Did it all get blown off when the planes hit? What happened? Why didn't that work? Why didn't that insulate the beams? That was the big question at the time.
Yeah, right.
Because we never fucking put it on. We stole the money, built swimming pools in Long Island. We didn't put it on. So kind of in a way, I think, well, that makes sense that, you know, all these scientists are trying to figure out why the insulation foam didn't protect the beams.
Because it's not
it's like, because it wasn't there.
Right.
But they never think about that. They never think about, well, we gave the job to mobsters and they didn't do it.
Right. Like, there's certain things that... Why did
Building 7 come down? Man, a lot of people are like, that just came down. It's like, do you understand that was Giuliani's headquarters? Do you understand that after the first 9/11, they had to have a command center? And they were, you know, the prevailing knowledge was you have to put it in Brooklyn. Because guess what? They want to hit downtown. That's where all the targets are. That's the target-rich environment. And Giuliani, America's mayor, the hero of 9/11, said, I don't do Brooklyn. You know where he built his command center? Building 7. They put, like, the whole basement was filled with all this propane and stuff so that they could actually manage to be in there for almost a year without any outside connection. Because that was the concept of the command center. Like, if things really went to hell, we have enough fuel. So the whole thing was just, it was like a pool of fuel, millions of gallons of fuel underneath. So as soon as something came down from the big center and lit the fire there, it caught that, and that just destroyed the building like
right.
very quickly. And that's why they pulled the firemen. They're like, we know what's in there.
Right.
We know that thing is full of propane and it's going down.
Right.
But it wasn't. They didn't pull the building because there's some magical secret
right.
government documents in there or something. It was because Giuliani put his command center in the wrong place. And, you know, thank God, at least now people are realizing who Giuliani is.
Yeah.
Because back then, because he was running up and down the streets because he had no command center. If his command center had been in Brooklyn, he would have been running across the Brooklyn Bridge, running the show from there.
Right.
But no, it's like, where's my command center? It went down.
Yeah, he
can't. And that's why he's on the streets, but it gave the image of him, you know, being
the
hero.
Yeah.
But he wasn't. He was the...
My only conspiracy theory is I always question the moon landing.
Nah, they went to the moon.
You think they went to the moon?
Yeah.
I just want it to be.
But also, you think it's depressing. It's depressing we went to the moon, and we were going forward, and there was so much hope, and then it ended.
Yeah, I think that's why.
Because
I've
it's way
been,
too expensive, and there's
yeah.
not much
and there's
up
nothing
there.
There
you know?
Yeah,
yeah,
no.
yeah.
And it's like they don't want to tell
and
us
And it's
that.
Super dangerous. Yeah. And we also don't like the concept of killing astronauts. And,
no, because it's public know. And it's, you know.
Right. It kind of holds us together as a nation. It's part yeah. of, again, it's a mythology that holds us together,
right.
you know.
What? We've gone all over the place here.
Yeah.
Wait, so
but
why?
That's a great thing about podcasts because, you know, every time you do an interview, you go like, I make toys. Oh, goody. Okay,
right,
bye.
Exactly. Yeah.
<You know?
laughs> But actually, we should. Why? What are you doing here at DesignerCon? I feel like we should touch on that because I feel.
Oh, I'm here with Pop Life. And so they bring me out every year. And then I sign stuff at their booth. Yeah. I'm not supposed to talk about this stuff. And now everybody's listening.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Ooh. No, but we have a giant shipping container, you know, stuck in the port. So that's why we're selling, like, the rest of our inventory.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So we don't have, like, all this great stuff we brought to make this epic exhibit is trapped. So we're
it's
having all kinds.
Stuck in Long Beach
so,
right
I mean,
now?
We're, yeah, yeah. I mean, everything is, the ports are messed up. Coming in from Mexico, like, so we went down there when we're building the border. But you learn a lot when you're building the border.
Absolutely.
Or when we're building
yeah.
our fake border wall.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, so we go in and we meet with the museum there. And they're going to help us actually fund part of the wall to be on the Mexican side, and they're giving us land there and stuff. But, you know, to come back, you used to be able to go back and forth in, like, you know, 20 minutes. You just walk across. You walk back over.
Right.
But now it's like they got trucks backed up for 3 days. All the produce is rotting. They put two people in there to run the whole show. One of our guys got flagged because he had a green card because he's from Holland, and then they were going to let him back into the country, and then he suddenly realizing, because, you know, it's very enlightening for him to go down there and see what's really going on. You know, because a lot of people don't know what's going on. Like when I took Daniel LaHota to Palestine, he goes, oh, shit. You know, I had
yeah,
no
yeah.
ideas in America because they don't tell us. And
right.
and the weird thing about Palestine is CNN was there, CNBC was there, and they're all standing around going, like, we don't know why we're here because we are not allowed to tell people what's going on here. So we don't know why we're here.
Right. It's almost
and
like.
And we're here in case maybe they run over you with a tank or something, I guess. I don't know. But but it's just like. We don't even know why they even bothered
yeah,
to send
here,
this because
they're
not.
We're here for the potential tragedy. That
yeah, but
really
but they're not going to tell us what's really. They do not tell the American people what's really going on there because that doesn't fit the narrative.
Well,
and the same thing
the
there.
And yeah, they have to re-explain
okay,
the narrative.
Yeah, so like, okay, well, you know, all the mess they create right there. But also it's a show because, you know, for about 10 miles, there's hundreds of agents and helicopters. And we built like at the Butterfly Center, they're cutting their land in half. So we built a wall there for them. And then they're going to actually be able to auction it off and raise money because they're destroying. They're cutting the land in half, even though like maybe they're a mile in from where the actual border is supposed to be. They're just taking their land. It's a land grab. And you know, conspiracy theory, they're like, we want to show you something. They're building a pipeline. Now, I don't know if they're building a pipeline. I see a lot of stuff. I don't know if that's – I don't.
Yeah, right, right.
But I don't know if that's a – but they're convinced. It's like they're just stealing the land to build a pipeline. I don't know if that's true, but they, you know, they showed us a lot of stuff, and we thought maybe that's true. I don't know. But they're definitely cutting their land in half and taking way more than they need.
That's the kind of stuff that – that would at least make sense then to me.
Yeah. But the interesting thing is, it's like every third car is a Border Patrol. It's, you know, all the press is there. That's where they go. And then we drive 10 miles down the road. And that's that famous picture of me walking through the border.
Yeah.
It's just wide open. And they got the big fence, and it just ends, and then it starts again. And
yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's just wide open. And people are just wandering over, you know. So how come you got thousands of people 10 miles down the road? And then, you know, so I just have to walk. Maybe it was even 5 miles. It wasn't that far. But,
yeah,
you know, so it's here's where the show's at. And if you really want to walk across, yeah, go down there. Because we need you. You know, you got to – we need some labor. So, but, yeah, but here's where the show is,
right.
You know.
Right.
I don't know. Yeah,
it's all fucked
up.
But when you, you know, I was thinking about this when you did the politics issue for Juxtapose and you curated that issue. And I went to your house and we kind of mapped out what we were going to do. I feel like we thought things were a little bit more positive then, but I think that's because we had 4 years of Obama. And things weren't that bad.
Right. Well, also I just think, you know,
not to say
negativity doesn't do anything for anybody. You know, negativity helps the evil. You know.
Right.
Right, and positivity helps the good. So we were trying to stay positive.
Right. Yeah, and I think we weren't trying to make a political statement with that issue. It was just about artists who worked in that
yeah.
practice.
Yeah, and because a lot don't now. A lot of people are too scared to be in politics.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of – but also this is like another one of my pet peeves. A lot of my friends are always going, there's no no political songs anymore. Back in the 60s, boy, there were these, you know, these great songs, you know, and
right.
And it's like, I just did three political rock operas.
Right.
Listen to one. Oh, yeah, but, you know, yeah, Bob Dylan isn't doing anything. Well, Bob Dylan, when Trump got elected, his audience, like, didn't applaud for anything. He just sitting there playing for him, and then he goes, what's wrong with the audience? And this is, and his musicians are like, do you not know what happened? He goes, what happened? And he goes, well, that guy Trump got elected. Oh, huh.
And back to playing hits.
No, but he's just like, he's not Bob Dylan anymore. He's a right. guy that goes around pretending to be Bob Dylan. But, I mean, he's not the young 60s radical.
Yeah, I mean, he.
But we have these people, but nobody will pay them any attention. The same people that, you know, bitch to me about there's no political music out there won't listen to my records.
Right.
Or promote them or help me with it. They just bitch, you know.
We had a great podcast with Molly Crabapple earlier this year. And she's still fighting the good fight.
No, she's good. She's good. Yeah. She's in the game.
Yeah, she's like...
Yeah. And she gets a certain amount of attention. She would get a lot more, like, Abbie Hoffman got a lot more attention than she did, and she's like our Abbie Hoffman.
Yeah,
so.
Okay.
But no, she is good, and she's rare.
Yeah, exactly.
But there are people here, but nobody's giving them any oxygen or attention.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And so that's other people's fault, you know?
Yeah, and I think that's a little bit of like, well, you know, you guys had your moment in the Obama years, and now it's like, now it's time to kind of... We're not going to talk about it. You know, you guys don't get your attention anymore.
Maybe.
I don't know. It just seems...
Or the media is on lockdown. Somebody came out of a meeting to CNBC, and then somebody I know that works there, and they were like, we're thinking about going all Trump all the time. I mean, pro-Trump. Because we're getting frustrated that Fox is making more news, although we are making more money than we ever have in the history of this network. So... There you go. Everybody's making money. Everybody, you know, so a lot of people are just like, well, we're not going to do the news because it's too expensive. We found a way to just make money all day long. It's a great formula. Trump tweets. We bring a bunch of people on all day. We don't pay them.
Right.
We don't pay them. But, you know, they have books, so they'll make money. It's okay. And then they just talk for free, and it costs us nothing to make these shows. It's brilliant. And we got more people watching, more people in a tizzy. It's the biggest, greatest soap opera ever, and it's aired on all three channels. And maybe more people are watching it on Fox than on our channel, but we're doing okay. We're doing okay. We're not sure if we're ready for there not to be a Trump, because we're used to all this money flowing in.
That's the thing that concerns me, is that people worried about the no Trump years when the news isn't as electrifying, because the presidency really isn't supposed to be an electrifying daily thing. You're really supposed to only hear from the president like once a week.
Or that was traditionally, yeah.
Traditionally, yeah.
Like, or you know, not at all. He's doing his job.
Yeah.
You know, and people always said, hey, you want to have a beer with Obama? And I'm like, I don't have a beer with Obama. I want him to do his job.
Right, exactly.
I'll have a beer with my friends that, right. you know, don't have as difficult of jobs.
When Obama's
you know?
Done, maybe yeah. I'll have a beer with him. But I really don't want to know anything about his workout schedule.
Right.
I don't want to know about Trump's golfing. I don't care.
Yeah.
Just do your job. Do you watch any TV shows? Are you a TV guy?
Oh, yeah, I
Are
like
you
TV,
a Netflix
yeah.
guy? Are you watching Succession? Did you watch it on HBO?
Succession. Yes. That, yeah. Yeah, that was a good
that
show.
That, to
yeah.
me...
But it had a happy ending, so...
So far.
No, it's over.
Is it over? Is
yeah,
it over,
yeah,
over?
That's it, yeah.
Oh, that was a great ending, then. This isn't going to have a happy ending, though, is it? Real life isn't going to have a happy ending.
I don't know.
Well, I don't know. Nixon,
but the weird thing
Nixon,
about
all this stuff.
But everybody goes, well, history's going to frown upon you. Not if you win, man.
Yeah.
If he wins and becomes dictator of the United States, the history books are going to talk about this great man that saved America.
Right.
And that's going to be nobody. Everybody's going to think that. Nobody's going to be a dissident. If they do, they're going to keep their mouth shut about it. So if he wins, then history's going to treat him very well. If he loses, it's going to be, whoops. You know, he's going to be just like, oh, my God, what were we thinking? But it depends on whether he wins or not, you know?
So are you planning, besides the...
But how's he going to deal with Trump, Putin? So, okay, let's say he becomes a dictator of the United States. Okay, now at some point, does he kick Putin to the curb? Or is he just too much of a mentor for him that he's going to keep him?
I know.
Because we're a way bigger and more powerful country than Russia.
Right. Yeah. Wait,
but we're letting them bully us now. Why?
Yeah, and like when Trump really finds out that we actually are more powerful. It seems like he hasn't figured that out
yet. No, I think he knows, but also Putin helped him come to power.
Yeah,
Manafort
so
took the playbook
to
from Putin. Yeah. You know, they were talking to each other. Here's how you do it. And he's doing everything the right way. He's ticking off all the boxes. So he knows what he's doing. And that, can he pull it off on this country? I don't know. Maybe we were asleep. Maybe he can do it. I don't know.
Yeah.
So if he wins, history books are going to be very kind to him. I still don't know what his relationship's going to be. If he actually becomes a dictator, gets rid of the free press, outlaws, you know, he's saying, let's not be able to criticize, you know, politicians anymore. If he pulls all that off, what happens? I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, I'm curious to see how's he going to deal with Putin after that.
Do you have...
But, you know, it's Obama's fault, too, because, you know, the NSA, he built up this huge spy network, you know, a fourth unaccountable branch of government, you know, and then sort of there was the idea, well, maybe he's a decent person, I don't know. But what happens when a despot gets a hold of all this and can know what we all do and think and walk and, you know?
Right.
Then what?
Right.
You know, so, I mean, Obama kind of set him up, you know? He gave him the tools.
Right.
And the tools were not meant for a criminal. They were meant for a patriot.
Do you have things planned in 2020, regardless of candidate, in terms of, like, your political, like, practice? Like, if it's Bernie Sanders or if it's Elizabeth Warren or if it's Mayor Pete or whatever, do you have anything planned or are you just watching it and waiting to see what happens?
I don't even have dinner planned today, so.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I'm kind of the same way.
No. I have, as soon as this year ends, I have nothing. I don't have any more shows. I don't have anything. Okay. It's all over. but that's another. Back in the old days, I had stuff planned out 5 years.
Right.
But you know, like about 5 weeks ago, they said, "Hey, do you want a space in Art Basel?" And so now we're doing that pop up. So I mean, I didn't know that was happening. Everything happens super fast now. So it's like you want your plate clean so you can take bigger opportunities. You know.
Right.
So. But yeah, I do believe in that once we get a candidate, we have to support them and push for them, and I'll find some way to do that.
Do you still find joy in just sitting in your studio and painting? Is that your favorite thing to do?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like all this other stuff in a weird way is I'm paying my dues, I'm buying time in the studio so I can do what I really want to do.
Right, okay.
The two things I like to do is paint and make music, you know, and everything else is, you know, if nobody knows who you are, nobody's going to buy your paintings. It's not going to happen, you know.
Right.
So,
right.
I mean, I could be a lot better at this kind of stuff. I could make art that's a lot easier to stomach, you know. So I haven't really brought myself to a point where I can just make banal, cute art that sells super easy. Or
right.
I don't know, I'm still kind of a rebel, but yeah, I'm still trying to buy time in the studio, and
right.
I still think that I have a lot to say with paint. You know,
that's
where. That I really am something special, you know.
I mean, you're an amazing painter, but does that?
But I have great ideas, you know.
And yeah.
I mean, it's. I'm at a high level, and maybe I got 10 more years before I won't even be able to do it anymore. So, I would like to be in the studio as much as I can.
But do you still feel like there's the power of the history of the painting that still means so much to you?
Of it.
Like just the idea that paintings stand, like there's a standing the test of time kind of thing with paintings.
Oh yeah, and
does
also,
that still kind of move you?
Yes, and you know, the thing about if you're a painter, I'm gonna go to somebody's painting show and see 10 times more than anybody else is seeing that show. Like somebody that's a super fan of sports, they're gonna have a far deeper experience watching a football game than I would.
Right.
You know, I'm gonna know who won and who lost, but I mean, if you know the minutia of it. You can actually have a lot deeper experience, and it's the same with painting. If you're really into painting, you know, to me, it's like I get the immense joy from seeing other painters, and especially people that operate at a super high level. And there's not a lot of them, but you know, I appreciate them. I think more than other people can.
Who are your the contemporary painters that you like?
Well, this is kind of like a great time. I mean,
I know, I
but,
agree
but,
with you.
But everybody, especially when you get to be my age or you know this age where you're completely matured. Like, say somebody like Alex Gray.
Yeah.
That guy is a phenomenon. Him and his wife, Allison, they're
up by you, correct?
They're by me, yeah. But, I mean, they are operating on a super, super, super high level.
And
you know, it took them a lifetime to get there.
He's a
magical
guy.
Yeah.
And I don't say that about too many people, but when you talk to him, you're like, oh, this guy's special.
Yeah, they're super, super smart. His wife, Allison's super smart.
Yep.
And just seeing somebody exist at that level is amazing, you know. And Mark Wrighton exists at that level, you know. And I mean, his paintings are just like the weird childhood dream fantasies, or he sees it like almost more real than it was, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah,
and
there's
and he's a beautiful painter. I mean, he's just a great painter.
And also, I noticed that the people I believe are truly, truly great are just weirdly humble, and it's almost like they don't have to tell you they're great. Like,
right.
They know that they, or they don't care about that. That's not what they're interested in. They're interested in just, like, I'm going to put everything I can onto that canvas, and I don't have to jump up and down and point at it or tell, you know.
I get that feeling from Mark Wrighton a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's there's no pretension.
Right, because he doesn't have time for that.
Yeah, exactly.
All of his energy is going into that painting.
Absolutely.
And he doesn't, you know, I could name other people that jump up and down and go, I'm a legend, look at me, you know. And it's like, yeah, right, you wrote your name on a wall, great.
Yeah, I mean, I love, like, Christian Rex Van Menen's paintings.
Yeah.
As kind of the generation after you, or maybe a couple generations after you.
But you're living through, and, you know, you're the epicenter of actually what is a renaissance. There has never been this much good art being produced.
I agree.
And it's been produced at a high level because artists are a lot more aware of everything that's going on in the world. They have access to more information, and you can't be a schmuck. You know, you have to be in the game and get any kind of respect. You can't get away with what you used to be able to get away with.
I feel like there's a period of time right now where it's almost overwhelming the talent in every part of the world.
Right.
Like, there's so many, there's so many people doing such good stuff.
Right.
You know, I just the other day was looking at this great painter from Hungary. You know, it's like, I never really had access to that, those kind of scenes before. Now it's.
Right. But this painter is also aware of what we're doing and what people are doing in China.
Yeah.
Where that wouldn't have happened before. Even if you were, like, in New York, the epicenter of the art world, it was still a small group of people kind of competing against each other.
Yeah.
And think of, like, I live in a small town, and I am the best basketball player in my town. And you know what? There's nothing to push me to be a better basketball player because I beat everybody. But then when you put me on a global stage, there's a guy in China that's going to kick my ass. And then I have to beat that guy. So, like, all these artists are seeing everybody, and now they have to really get any attention, you have to be better. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so there's a higher level of competition.
So you think competition's good in the art world?
I think competition's...
Technical competition.
Is good, and critique is good, you know, in all professions.
Yeah.
No, you don't want to ever destroy your opponent. You want to make your opponent better so you can beat them again.
Yeah, right, exactly.
No, but you want them to do great, too. You know, but you want to use that energy of, like, even when we started doing the billboards, you know, I thought I was, like, really good at it, and I'm doing stuff, and then this guy Jeff Robinson jumps in, another young painter, and he does some pretty cool stuff, and I think, okay, next time we go out, I got to beat him, and I would do something better, and, you know, and I mean, so, but we were all competing against each other, but we were all best friends, too. We all hoped the best for each other, and we were on the same side, and so I think some people mistake competition is like it's a destructive force that you don't destroy your opponent, you make your opponent better.
Yeah.
So you can compete with them so you can always stay on the same level and when we get to a higher level, I want you on that higher level with me
right.
So we can push the culture forward, you know?